Welcome back to Agents of Cool, where we return tonight to the swingin' free love 60s as we open Channel D and examine The Man from U.N.C.L.E. We're going to have to start on a slightly down note, I'm afraid. As we record this, today is the day we lost the irreplaceable, magnificent, protean even, writer Harlan Ellison. And again, if you're listening to this show, there's a better than even chance you know who Harlan Ellison is, but if not, go educate yourself. A magnificent writer of short fiction and television and essays and commentary and criticism, and probably more than a few legal briefs, but it was all for a good cause. He was absolutely magnificent. The guy that comes up with the words for Harlan Ellison should be Harlan Ellison, but Harlan's not here, so you're stuck with me tonight. Harlan was incredible, an incredible writer, fascinating person, colorful and legendary. Now, we had had a request, a standing request, to look at another episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the classic 60s spy TV show. So tonight, on account of the loss of Mr. Ellison, we're going to be looking at his show tonight. He wrote a lot of TV in the 60s, including City on the Edge of Forever, and there's a whole great episode, tons of controversy about it. We're not the Star Trek show tonight, so the episode he wrote for The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was called The Pieces of Fate Affair. He gets a story credit and a teleplay credit. This was broadcast on February 24th, 1967. It was episode 23 of season 3. Stacy, what was it broadcast? It was broadcast the day after.
It was the day after A Taste of Armageddon first aired on the original Star Trek.
To number one, drop some interesting trivia on you, and number two, give you a little context for when this show would have aired. So let's see. Now, we have watched The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the movie from a couple of years ago, and we all loved it, even though it didn't do bupkis at the box office. So we're coming to this not from... So when we watch Mission Impossible movies, we're kind of coming to them from the point of view of people who have watched Mission Impossible, the TV show, before. U.N.C.L.E. wasn't really stuff that we had had a lot of experience with until we saw the movie. So we're kind of seeing the contemporary origin story and then feeding back into the TV show. The first thing I feel like I should observe is that Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer are both built like freaking Terminators. And Robert Vaughn and David McCallum. Doesn't he remind you of that guy on
NCIS? Yes.
Reminds me a lot of that guy on NCIS. So yeah, they are relatively slender guys. They are not huge muscle men. They do give you the impression of being capable in a fight, but they are not the purebred, genetically engineered, cons, eugenic supermen that Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer are. That seems to be the major difference for me between the world the movie presents and the world I see in the TV show. The builds of the actors seem to be radically different, but the spirit of the one thing seems to flow pretty nicely into the spirit of the other thing, in my opinion. So this is called The Pieces of Fate Affair. It opens in there's a local talk show. A guy named Joe White is having guests on, and Solo and Kuryakin, our heroes, slip into the audience, the relatively small studio audience, just as the show is beginning. This Joe White, this talk show guy, is having three guests on tonight, one of which is a Nazi, another of which is a guy who claims to have been kidnapped by a UFO, and the third is a school teacher who has written a controversial spy novel called Pieces of Fate. The school teacher's name is Jacqueline Midcult. And she comes out, and the talk show host immediately jumps on her for this being basically a dirty book. Which also makes me think the way that Ian Fleming's novels were frequently, what were they called? Sadism for the Whole Family?
Yes.
Is that what Connery said?
That's famously attributed to him.
Famously attributed to Connery. Sadism for the Whole Family. And Miss Midcult takes offense that her book is called Dirty. So we cut from the talk show to a hotel room. A couple of thugs are tossing what I believe is Miss Midcult's hotel room. They're looking for the diaries that apparently she has used. Did they mention the diaries yet?
They mentioned something that she has. She must have taken it with her, and she's scheduled to die in 4 minutes.
Well, what can we do? Watch.
Just watch. So they turn the TV show on, and suddenly a thrush operative approaches the microphone in the studio and proceeds to attempt to machine gun the stage, the talk show host, and Miss Midcult. Solo and Kuryakin give chase. They lose the guy. They come back, and bam, we cut to the titles. Now, what we had checked, and now, Stacey, you said before we watched the episode tonight, that they had shifted showrunners a couple of times, trying to change the tone of U.N.C.L.E. fairly radically a couple of different times to capitalize on the success of Batman. This kind of startles me because I was under the impression that Man from U.N.C.L.E. had been a really hot show back in the day. And I don't know if ratings had dropped or something. I don't know why one hit show would feel the need to change its direction to capitalize on the success of another hit show.
Because more ratings means more money.
Yeah, I guess so. I was telling my kid earlier that it's always about that bad decisions are usually about money.
Batman was sort of this weird pop culture hit in a way that Man from U.N.C.L.E. maybe wasn't. Like, it had all the merchandise and there was the Batmania.
Now, the weird thing about this is I was under the impression that U.N.C.L.E. was, in fact, a kind of that there was an Uncle Mania, if you will. Hmm.
Well, you might be right.
So
maybe by the third season it had dropped off. I don't
know. Maybe there's a drop in ratings. They're trying to capitalize on something else to give themselves a boost late in the run.
It doesn't have to be an actual drop in ratings. It can't. I mean, it's network TV. The executives are going to say, "Well, do this stupid thing because I am the producer or the network executive and think this was a good idea." This is, of course, never happened to Harlan Ellison before in his career.
Oh no, perish the very thought.
I mean, you know, especially not involving Mayans in a Star Trek movie. No, of course not.
Make very clear you're being sarcastic. He may not have believed in an afterlife, but we do, and there's no telling. You say stuff like that, he's going to show up. You're going to be visited in your dreams tonight by a short man who's a writer, and he's going to be
an angry short writer
in your dreams tonight.
We've seen this. I mean, it's not unique to the 60s. I mean, we've seen this with any time the network or somebody gets involved and says, okay, we totally should do this thing over here, forgetting that most TV producers and executives are basically people, to borrow a phrase from Ellison, people who went to sleep next to a big bag of money.
More or less, yeah.
And there's always the whole, well, sure, it's successful, it's making us money, but it could be making us more money.
Well, yeah, there's that.
Or just that desire, I want to put my new guy comes in, they want to put their stamp on it. And, I mean, okay, you see this in comic books, you see this in other TV shows, it's like, new guy comes in, and they want to put their stamp all over it.
Yeah. So, spoiler alert, we didn't find this episode tonight particularly reminiscent of Batman.
I did.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No,
some of the cinematography.
Cinematography and just the little interstitial cuts between scenes.
That was sort of Batman-ish. Yeah. But it could have been other shows.
I thought the little interstitials were something Uncle was doing before Batman was even on the air.
I'm not sure. It was just the little whip pan across the blurry stuff there that just kind of, that and the music kind of reminded me. And again, there were a couple times where it's like, and now we will leave our heroes in a cliffhanger. I mean, it really...
But that's just a standard TV writing. You leave your heroes in trouble when you cut to commercial to make sure people come back after they get their sandwich during the break.
In this particular one where they were put into a slightly contrived death trap, it wasn't like we're being Batman, but I could see, I could see some similarities. I mean, not like we're doing the shot for shot, but... And some of it may just be the way they filmed stuff and just what was considered, okay, this is the way you do the freeze frame cut and those transitions.
Fair enough.
I mean, like Mission Impossible, which was a little bit later, you didn't really see that little voop, the little spin pan kind of...
No, they didn't do that. That was outside their style.
And I haven't watched a lot of 60s TV, to be honest. I mean, outside of the Andy Griffith Show or whatnot, but I don't really remember the little zoop, the little... Mm. Maybe a little bit on Gilligan's Island?
Yeah, probably on the really silly sitcoms, yeah.
But, so I don't know if that was just considered, you do this on comedies or you do this, I'm not being a 60s TV, TV cinematography, photography historian, I'm not sure if that technique was widely used or not.
Although we do watch a lot of 60s TV, it's very specific 60s TV rather than a general knowledge of 60s TV.
But, I did get a couple of hints, because there's a bit where they get put in a death trap, and... they have to kind of get, escape from the death trap. And again, it wasn't like a giant magnifying glass or they were tied up to the hands of a gigantic clock. But
it was still a bit of a weirdly slow moving, like, instead of killing you here, we're just going to let some other thing that's going to happen kill you.
Yeah. And that, as James Bond's aficionados, we can't really complain when he says, I will now put you in this incredibly elaborate death trap, Mr. Bond. But part of it, and this is one thing just in general, I was surprised by how relatively bloodless the whole thing was. And this is a 60s TV show, so you can't simply have...
You can't do like CSI does, not CSI, but NCIS. Mm-hmm. You can't do like the crime shows do these days and like have someone's brain on a plate in the morgue during the commercial for the show. You can't have like Ducky like elbow deep in some guy's innards in the 60s.
Right, but I mean, just in terms of the body count, I mean, the very first Uncle we saw, had those killers, shoot their way into Uncle HQ and come very close. But this seemed a little more punching back and forth and, I've got the drop on you. No, I've got the drop on you. It was just sort of like, one Luger trumps two Lugers trumps one Luger back and and I guess, again, it's not going to devolve down into a giant gunfight and we're not going to see something like out of like the Bourne movies where it's just, limbs flying left and right. But that took a little recalibrating. I'm like, I was expecting it to be Thrush to be a lot more vicious, a lot more Spectre-esque.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and of course we've seen this in our share of Mission Impossible TV episodes as well. Maybe we just picked the weird ones, but the subject matter itself was just sort of fluffy and...
I mean, ostensibly, and I guess we should probably just at this point
get into the subject matter.
The format of Uncle, as I understand it, is that the world of spies and espionage intrudes on a relatively normal person's life. Then Solo and Kuryakin show up into your little world someday, and then you go on an adventure. And this week's episode, it seems to be the school teacher, Jacqueline Milkulty, who has a best-selling novel out. And now this is weird. This is just me. I work in education in like my real life, and I was working with a second grade teacher. I'm not going to call her name on the podcast because I don't know that she needs that.
And she can drive over to your house and knife you.
So. Yeah, she could, because not that she would.
But she could.
So anyway, there's the school teacher on this episode looks reminiscent of, and her body language and her voice and her facial expressions, it's like watching this very specific person that I've worked with. So this is a TV show from 50 years ago that features a character who is something very close to a doppelganger for somebody actually in my regular life. And how weird is that?
That's kind of weird.
And that's pretty weird. So anyway, we get back to Hunkle. Ma Hunkle, the Red Tornado from Golden Age DC. Mm-hmm. Leighton, that one was for you. Get back to Uncle Headquarters. There's the thing here. The acts in this, it's a four-act show. Each act has its own title. So they will actually show these on screen. So act one, we come back to Uncle Headquarters, and they're talking about what the show's going to be about. Miss Midcult has partial amnesia. She doesn't remember everything about everything. But it looks like there's a very strong correlation between her spy novel and some actual Thrush Uncle cases. And they're concerned that wherever she got the information for these past things, that there may be future things that Uncle would like to know about before they happen. So Ilya and Napoleon are trying to nursemaid her into getting her memory back.
And it's worth pointing out, I mean, some of those things are things I'm like, that would be kind of neat to see, you know, the Thrush floating headquarters that they're going to use to inject anthrax into the jet stream, or their top female agent, April Dancer, dispenses with their top assassin and the top Mount Vesuvius or Mount Etna.
In real life, it was Mount Etna. In the book, it was Mount Vesuvius.
And now we would love to see those things, but we're a TV show in the 60s. And we don't have that kind of money.
Oh, I did find out, by the way, the name dropping of April Dancer, apparently the one season of The Girl from U.N.C.L.E., which featured Stephanie Powers, I think.
Stephanie Powers.
As April Dancer ran concurrent with that same season of U.N.C.L.E.
Name drop there, cross-promotioning the thing. Okay.
So then we find out our Thrush villain in Thrush, like New York headquarters for the week. And I want you to sit, if you're not sitting down, I want you to sit down as I say this. You're going to love this so much. The villain's name is, wait for it, Ellipsis Zark. And I can't tell you how happy it makes me just to say that name. But I love it. Ellipsis Zark. Maybe someday, 50 years from now, on my deathbed, my last words are going to be Ellipsis Zark. Just for the fun of it and to get the looks.
I understand. The actor is bald and has, I guess, an artificial hand.
It looks like he just has aluminum foil.
It
looks like he's wearing like a silver oven.
So, I mean, they're very much trying to evoke Dr. No and Blofeld. Right, right. And he gives this little speech. And that's the thing.
Or is that Ellison referencing his own work? Demon with a Glass Hand. The episode of Outer Limits that he wrote had Bob Culp in it, remember?
I think it was a Dr. No send up because you got the bald thing. And he's
bald and he's got the mechanical hand.
And what was this act titled? Those Who Do Not Have Bubblegum Cards and Do, Those Who Do.
And Those Who Do.
Because he goes with this, the henchman, the thug, the agent.
The guy that tried to shoot Miss
The guy that tried to shoot her and didn't.
Is pleading his case because he has, you know, failed, and he's like, I'm loyal Thrust agent, I've worked for 15 years. And Zark is giving this extended thing about when he was 13 years old.
It was his first original thought.
Yes. He was 13 years old. He killed a playmate over a set of bubblegum cards.
There were two bubblegum cards Zark wanted that the playmate would not give up, so he killed him.
There are those who have bubblegum cards and those who do not. And then he shoots the henchman. And
he shoots the henchman.
Says, there's a mess in my office to be cleaned up. And then tells them to call some agent who we will see in a moment. But, I mean, it's a complete, I don't want to say send up, but it's very close to almost a send up of the bit there where Blofeld is ruminating on, you know, his life in early Belgium when the thing they're sending up in Austin Powers.
Or Mike Myers has watched his uncle. Has watched his uncle.
I mean, they're sending up the same source material, somewhat lovingly, but I mean, it
feels like a very loving, I don't know what Ellison would have said about it, but it feels like a very loving send up to me. I mean, I don't sense any nastiness towards the kind of very, you know, lurid, pulpy material this is referencing.
No, the nastiness is saved for the New York literary critics.
Speaking of which, we get to
the part that apparently led to an actual real-world legal controversy surrounding this episode. The agent, the apparently newly joined Thrust agent, that Zark contacts is Judith Merle, an acid-penned literary critic, named after Harlan Ellison's friend Judith Merle, who is a sci-fi writer and editor. Apparently, she did not have a problem with this portrayal, but her daughter did. And so this episode was not actually shown on TV again until 1985.
Wow.
Wow. As someone who is mostly a TV writer would have never thought to make a New York book critic a thrush agent. That's somebody with a special kind of hate reserved for book and literary critics in general. And I can't say that I blame him. Apparently it's her first day on the job, right?
Yeah, she's apparently just newly minted thrush agent. And
though, as she said, she assassinates people in her own way.
Assassinates people in her own way. So naturally, they're going to try to take care of poor Miss Midcult. So Thrush asks Miss Merle to have a literary cocktail party.
I guess that's a thing.
I guess that's a thing.
I don't know.
We've seen it in other movies and things.
We've seen other movies.
No, I just I've never been to a cocktail party, so I'm like, I don't really.
Right, but writers and agents and so forth have them, and they all hobnob. Again, I've seen it portrayed in other.
We've seen it portrayed in TV shows. A literary cocktail party, like each one of those is capitalized, capital LCP. Solo and Kuryakin accompany Miss Midcult to the literary cocktail party, and it's probably just as snooty and as obnoxious as you think it would be. From this cocktail party, Miss Midcult is kidnapped, bopped on the head.
With her own book.
With her own book.
One of the guys that was tossing the room earlier is there, and he and Miss Merle exchange secret spy signals in a very obvious way.
They do not use semaphore flags, but almost.
That's not super subtle. So, and again, that bopped Miss Midcult on the head with her own book, which is not what I think someone in a 60s TV show should do if you're trying to avoid amnesia. Because we all grew up on TV, and like the one thing guaranteed to give you amnesia is a sharp blow to the head.
Well, but if you get it again, you sometimes get your memory back.
Yeah, is that like the...
King Tut, Batman.
Yeah, King Tut, Batman.
Like quicksand should have been a much bigger problem in life.
I was going straight to quicksand. There you go. You get amnesia by getting hit on the head. You get your memory back by getting hit on the head again. And quicksand's a life-threatening problem in all 50 states. Well, so
right. You relax, you float up, and then you just sort of work your way. I mean, it's water. You just
We all know how to deal with it, but I expected to have to deal with it more. By which I mean at all.
It's not like it's copperheads, man.
I've never been in quicksand.
I lived in mortal fear of copperhead snakes the first 6 or 8 years I spent on planet Earth.
I'm going to be 47 in 2 weeks, and I have never once been trapped in quicksand. And I'm kind of disappointed about that. I thought it would have been a thing by now. But no, I guess not. So the Thrush henchmen, they get Solo, they get Kuryakin, and we'll fix you. And they throw them down a coal chute in the basement of a New York tenement building.
Right, and they're just going to wait for someone to dump a bunch of coal in there so they will die.
They're dumped in there, and they slide to the bottom of the chute, and it kind of freeze frames, and we cut, we fade to commercial. And
now, they are conscious, largely uninjured, and dumped in a coal chute.
And just tied up and gagged.
Probably in a couple of days, somebody will dump some coal on you. Ha!
And part of it, again, we can't really complain too much. The bad guy, we have you completely in our power. We're not going to shoot you. Now, to be fair, in Goldfinger, this is subverted because, we're going to kill you horrifically. And then Bond, wiggles out by making him think, maybe he knows something. Well, we can't kill him. He might know something. We need to know what he knows.
In Goldfinger, Oryk wasn't going anywhere. He was going to stand there, eat his popcorn, have a Coke, and watch the laser bisect Commander Bond, starting with his nuts.
Yes.
So he wasn't going anywhere. He was settling in for the long haul.
Yeah, and that's one where I'm like, this is just, we're going to viscerally kill you. And they're kind of subverting the I'm going to put you in a death trap trope. Because, it's not that trope. I mean, this is basically, we're now going to kill you horrifically and why? But in this case, we're not going to do that. We're going to put you down a coal chute, and we're going to walk away. You're tied up. You're conscious.
Claim that you have been permanently dealt with.
And again, this is where I realize modern spy movies where, your hyper-action, high-octane, Bourne, Mission Impossible.
A more modern action movie, they'd have, 10 Thresh killers in tactical gear and, laser sights. And, Solo and Kuryakin would be, doing, Jason Bourne moves and kicking and spinning around, and bones would crunch and teeth would fly and blood would splatter on the walls. And they'd have their heads ripped off their shoulders, and it'd be awesome.
They walk outside the cocktail party and realize they just walked right into a kill box. And then basically you have this 15-minute scene of them shooting their way up fire escapes, otherwise getting out of it.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Well,
I've got that in my head now. That's totally awesome.
So that is not what happened in this episode.
Happened this episode, so y'all don't get your hopes up. So we cut back to Miss Midcult being interrogated by Ellipsis Zark and Judith Merle, the book critic. They're not getting anywhere because she doesn't remember anything. We cut back to the coal chute, and they wiggle out of the ropes.
Solo doesn't have the gag on. Kraken's like, and he just pulls it down with his hands. He's like, oh.
Because his hands, while tied, aren't actually restrained. So he just pulls the gag off. Mm-hmm. So the gag is he pulls the gag off. And they realize they're not really in any danger from the coal because Ilya figures out that this building runs on an oil furnace instead of a coal furnace.
So they're in no danger whatsoever. So this is the thing. You know, there's a bit of banter back and forth because, you know, Solo wants to get out of there before they dump the coal. They're supposed to mess up his hair, and Kraken's like, that's unlikely to mess up your hair. And at first I thought, because of the amount of moose in it? No, okay, actually, because, oh, it's an oil furnace. And I'm like, at that point you realize...
That was at least a cute little experience.
Yeah, it was, but I'm just like, we're dealing with the Thrush B team here.
Now, see, which gets more obvious as we get to the next scene. Well, Ellipsis Zark, and I am never going to get tired of saying that, Ellipsis Zark and Miss Merle have Miss Midcult set up in front of a hypno wheel, which looks like just a big piece of cardboard with primary colored lights behind it that they spin in her face. And this is the point where the Thrush thing kind of goes off the rails for me, because I'm thinking the hypno wheel thing is kind of your late period Cobra Command. You know, if you got any of your Joe people out there, crystal ball, raise your hands. Yeah, so we're not, the Thrush B team is apparently very, very similar to the Cobra Command C team.
Well, you've got, okay, the whole thing.
Hypno,
you know,
wheel.
No, come on, you know, the you know,
hypno
the,
wheel.
We're going truth serum, we're going to use hypnosis, we're going to program a sleeper agent to.
This is, do you remember crystal ball?
Yeah, yeah, no.
You remember
yeah.
crystal ball?
Dr. Mindbender, yeah.
No. Mindbender's A team. He's a freak, but he's A-team. Crystal Ball is not A-team.
Mindbender was...
He's a dentist with a leather fetish, but he's A-team. He's A-team.
I think that makes you B-team material. Because when you think, okay, we want to recruit our top secret psychological warfare brainwashing expert from, like, bent Harvard doctors who couldn't pass the institutional review board. No, we have a dentist with a leather fetish? That's the best you can do?
Yeah, but he's got a gift.
I'm just... It...
Mindbender built Serpentor, all right? And I'm not saying...
Oh, that worked out so well for the organization.
I'm not saying it worked out, but he's a dentist who is able to clone a man, all right? I don't know what dental school
didn't
he went
Commander
to, but that's
Didn't
Cobra
Commander start out doing, like, Amway sales or something?
If you read... That's the book of Larry Hama right there.
Yep.
Cobra Commander was a used car salesman who felt shafted by the collapse of the American dream, started doing a pyramid scheme Amway type of thing, and from there built it into a world-shattering terrorist organization. Now, of course, in the cartoon, you didn't get any of that. In the cartoon, he ended up being a sleeper agent from the lost civilization of Cobra Law in the Himalayas.
Cobra La 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 La.
So, which, of course, Cobra Law, as we all know, it's total bullshit.
Yeah, that's
when it
they
really
should have listened to Larry.
No, they didn't ask Larry about that.
But okay, Larry was writing. Here's Larry's books. Larry's right there. You can pick up the phone, dial 1-800-MARVEL, Excelsior. Can I please meet Larry Hama? We have no clue.
So, Thrush, and I do think Thrush and Cobra Command are calling the same employment agencies.
But we haven't even gotten to what the hypno wheel does.
Between that and the drug, because they drug her, so it's not just flashing lights, they get the hypo, so they presumably have dosed her up with scalpamine or sodium pentothal.
They're trying to liberate her id and her libido, which I thought was going to go in a completely different direction, but...
60s TV, there's only... 60s,
again, this would have been a very different story if made in the 21st century. And I'm
movie, I think. I mean, go look at Our Man Flint.
We need to do Flint.
We do.
We really got to do Flint one of these days, because Michael Myers has watched his Flint too.
Yes.
So anyway, what happens to Miss Midcult is she thinks she's 7 again.
Yes.
No, that does cause her to remember the time that she went to visit her Uncle Charlie and Aunt Jessie in
Mainesville, Ohio.
That's right.
And this doesn't make a lot of sense, but we'll get there. Never mind. I'm talking about sense. What the hell?
We had found out earlier that the one part of her life that Uncle hasn't been able to track down are a small period of months that she spent in Mainesville, Ohio.
And to be fair, you know, right before they said that, I'm like, they're a spy agency. Shouldn't they have, you know, pretty much been able to just backtrack everywhere she's been and just, you know, have agents canvassing the place? And, well, yep, we know where she's been. We're actually over this 5-month period. We're not sure where, you know, we don't know where she was.
Small town Ohio, we don't know.
Yeah, they think the manuscript was posted from Ohio. That's the best we can find out.
Best we can find out. And remember, that's pretty good for what we're 12 hours into the story at that point.
Yeah,
maybe.
No, that's fair.
That's pretty good for a pre-internet spy agency in the 60s to have your entire life except for the 5 months you actually need.
And Ilya has come up with the fact that presumably the only place that someone could have gotten all these details from, if she was not already affiliated with Uncle or Thrush, is from the diaries of former Thrush agent Charles Coltrane.
Now, for those of you who are jazz people, Charles Coltrane, there's Charlie Bird Parker and John Coltrane. So I'm pretty sure Charles Coltrane is a jazz reference. And I know that Ellison was a jazz fan. Charlie Bird Parker, Charles, John Coltrane, the saxophonist. Pretty sure that's a jazz reference, but I digress.
So, yeah, they're thinking there may be information of other operations or upcoming operations from Thrush in these diaries if they can get their hands on them.
Right, but the girl who should know where those diaries are thinks she's seven.
Right, and Thrush has obviously come to the same conclusion because they're trying to find out where the diaries are from her as well.
For reasons unclear, we next see Solo and Kuryakin in a sauna.
Yeah, I wasn't entirely clear on that.
Yeah, I'm
point
not sure
either.
Why not.
They're apparently listening in on the bugging device they planted in Jacqueline's earring.
So, and that was
which
I thought,
clever,
which is, you know, fine.
And I thought
you
that know, was kind whatever. Of a neat callback because remember there was the bit in the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie where, oh hey, they you know they bugged a piece of jewelry they gave to
Alicia, to the Tomb Raider, Alicia Vikander.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, that's neat. So
there's that. And then they follow her. They're in a sauna for whatever. I mean, they just felt like taking a, what is it, a Schwitz? Is that what you say? They needed a Schwitz, whatever. And then apparently Jackie's tossed in the bag in the back of a truck and we have a truck fight.
Right. So they apparently it's not just a listening device. It is some kind of tracking beacon because they're next we see them. It's dark. They're wearing dark clothing and they're listening to their little radio pin. There's a beeping noise and he says the beeps are getting closer. And then the truck kind of comes around the corner. So obviously they have been following her, following the little listening device with their cool uncle radio pin. And then a fight ensues.
And it's okay. It's an okay TV fight. It's okay. It's not the best action scene I've ever seen, but it's pretty good for TV.
Yeah, it's serviceable. It goes on for a bit, and I'm like, I'm kind of like, well, this, and it, again, it kind of reminded me of the fights from Batman. But again, I don't know if they're trying to kind of do Batman. Was it just, that's what fight choreography in the 60s looked like?
Ilya seems to be, well, he does punch people, unlike Batgirl, who was apparently never allowed to punch people. But he does seem to kind of inherit the... Well, I guess she wouldn't even have existed yet, but anyway, he has sort of the same role that Batgirl eventually has on Batman, in that he kind of hoists himself up on things and kicks people.
Okay.
He does do a lot of flipping.
No, I think there would have been a Batgirl by now.
Wasn't until third season of 66 to 69, so I don't know if in 67 there would have been.
I thought Batman ran to 68.
It started in 66, though.
My dates are messed up. Somebody make a note. We'll do that for our Batman podcast someday. So there's a fight scene in the...
We do that. Y'all are learning audio editing. I'm just going to just line that out there.
Okay. So, yeah, they get the girl back. They go back to Uncle headquarters, and Napoleon is trying to get her to take a promises her ice cream, or she'll take a pill that'll bring her memory back. So that's not a little creepy.
It's a little weird, and she's like, there's an early, there's an earlier scene where there is, when they're initially interviewing her, that there's a bit of tension because, Robert Vaughn in the 60s is... not an unattractive gentleman, and
sure.
The actress is not an attractive actress, and she keeps kind of looking at him, and he keeps trying to keep it relatively focused on actual spy business.
It's a little weird because it turns out Napoleon Solo isn't actually allowed within 1,000 feet of a school, so that was a little weird.
Huh?
I'm sorry. The whole thing just had a really creepy vibe. I'll give you ice cream, little girl, if you'll take the pills.
Oh, yeah, no.
It's really weird.
You
want some ice cream, little girl? Take the pill. Jesus, Napoleon.
Yeah, they couldn't just dart her with...
They couldn't dart her. They couldn't trank her. They couldn't... You've got to do the whole pedo with the ice cream cone thing here.
The conference table John apparently spins around.
Wee!
Yeah, it's just kind of like... And again, everybody else is like, this is going off the rails here. This is not nuclear missiles and nuclear blackmail. Our key witness is drugged out of her mind and thinks she's seven.
Although in the 60s, a lot of their key witnesses were probably drugged out of their
minds. Yeah, but
this
is just, again, this is where I think, it's definitely kind of the send-up. This is the uncle case that makes you wish for just straightforward nuclear blackmail and ninja assassins on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius.
Now, what we got to do now is probably watch some more Uncle to see if this is representative of the period. Because I'm getting the impression here that Channing Tatum in a cowboy hat's a better spy than Napoleon Solo at this point. And God forgive me for saying that.
Well, no, again,
Robert Vaughn, as you said, spends a lot of the episode just kind of sitting there looking kind of blankly at the screen, like he also doesn't believe what is going on around.
This is where Harlow Ellison's kind of doing maybe a bit of a send-up, maybe a bit of, this is the slightly weird episode. This is the extra weird. This is the one where... normally the Men from U.N.C.L.E. come through somebody's life and grab your toaster off the sink and drown it in the bathtub to prevent New York from being wiped out by a nuclear weapon. So normally the Men from U.N.C.L.E. are the people that are coming in and turning your life upside down. And instead, and this is actually kind of brilliant, and again, Harlan Ellison, here is this second grade school teacher who has come in and kind of turned the spy agency upside down.
That's kind of fun.
They're like, she doesn't remember. She thinks she's 7 years old. And we kind of have to...
As I recall, Mr. Ellison had a propensity for dating actresses. Makes me wonder, makes me wonder if Mr. Ellison, and I don't remember the actress's name, that just makes me wonder, that's all.
It is kind of a flip of the typical Uncle script of, okay, bam, we're now this person has turned the whole spy agency upside down. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of neat in that it's turning the whole premise upside down.
It changes your expectations, yeah. So anyway, they end up on a train to Ohio with Miss Midcult in an unbelievable eyesore of a dress. It's a very op art black and white pattern that I'm surprised actually didn't short out televisions in the 1960s. And for those of you, if you actually go back and watch this show on DVD, do keep a close eye on where Robert Vaughn's eyes are going in that scene. Where every other guy's eyes were going. Which makes me feel very uncomfortable because this woman reminds me a lot of somebody I know, but whatever. So I'm really kind of uncomfortable with this whole show. So anyway, they get to Mainesville. They get off the train. There's a bumpkin at the train station. And then suddenly, dun, dun, da, the book credit comes out of the train station. She's gotten there ahead of them.
Jacqueline remembers that there's a bookstore.
Buck's Books. They go on their merry way. And then the literary critic, you know, shows up and calls.
Dun, dun, da.
You know, gets in the phone booth and calls over and says, they're on the way to the bookstore. Are you ready? And apparently they are. And
so here we
are. Bookstore.
And so here we are. Now, act three. They go to the bookstore, Buck.
Meet the delightfully eccentric Mr. Buck.
And when she says delightfully eccentric, what she means is creepy loon. But whatever. Apparently, Miss Midcult's book has sold 16 copies right there in Mainesville. So he's just over the moon with excitement about the revenue he's getting from this.
Yes, and apparently he gargled a thesaurus right before they shot this scene.
Yeah. God bless you, Mr. Ellison. That was some nice, chewy dialogue right there. There's a scene they talk, and her memory comes back. She wrote part of the book in this bookstore. And she remembers, oh gosh, Uncle Charlie and Aunt Jessie.
Buck tells them where to find Uncle Charlie and Aunt Jessie. He knows that the diaries or the notes, that the sources she was using exist, but he doesn't know where they are.
So, now in the meantime, Ilya has decided to go off and be a distraction. In case Thresh is already on the scene, he wants to divert their attention a little bit to give Napoleon some room to work. And so he is promptly knocked across the head.
He comes up on the bookstore and looks down an alleyway. And right before this, you know, there was a shot of an older gentleman looking through a window in on Buck and the school teacher and Napoleon Solo.
It's like an obviously rubber face.
Yeah, so we're not sure what's going on there. And
strangely, it's a 60s spy show and it's an obviously rubber mask, but he doesn't look anything like either Leonard Nimoy or Martin Landau in makeup.
That's weird.
So that's weird. So I don't know what that's about. That's weird.
So Kurakin comes down there, and there's the literary critic, and he gets the drop on her, and then the guy on the ladder whacks him with his cane and knocks him out, and then the literary critic's going to kill him, and he says, no, we can keep him as a hostage. And so he goes drag her off, and she asks, well, when did you come in? You know, when did you get here? And he's like, oh, I'm from, you know, Unit X-14 that came up on the morning train. He's like, oh. So he drags Kurakin off. Okay, and then we cut to the uncle's house.
Do we go to Uncle Charlie's house? Yes. This one, we're at Uncle Charlie's house. Uncle Charlie is just as down home and friendly a bumpkin as you could possibly want. Happy to see Jacqueline. Come on in. Mr. Solo, you city slicker bastard, you come on in too. It'll be great.
Now, the aunt's away at a funeral in Akron.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and they come on in, and then, you know, Uncle Charlie throws out a dinner for him, and they're talking. And
oh, but wait.
Oh, but what? What?
But before.
What?
Before. You know, they get there, and then we cut up to... There is Ellipsis Zark looking through a window down upon the proceedings. He is in the house.
Ellipsis Zark. And we cut to Act 4 on Zark in Uncle Charlie's house, eavesdropping on them. So, God help us all. What is going on?
And the thing, the uncle does seem a little off when he says the aunt is at a funeral in Akron. And
now, so, the first thing I thought was probably Uncle Charlie has killed Aunt Jessie, and, you know, she's in the crawl space.
Well, I was wondering, okay, you know, I was wondering.
But again, this is the 60s, and we didn't really do that.
You know, I was wondering, okay, you don't set up an aunt and an uncle and then just have one not there unless. And then when they pan up to Zark, I'm like, okay, obviously they've gotten there ahead of time and they have taken the aunt hostage or something. But.
So we get to. So, yeah, it's. This one's not. The plotting's. You're not wrong. So, Act 4, entitled The Last Chapter. So Act 4 in a 4-act story is called The Last Chapter. So they're having dinner with Charlie, and it's fine, and Zark is eavesdropping on them.
They look around the house, and we cut back to Kurakin, who's been deposited by the older gentleman who knocked him out, and he sets a candle there and says something to the effect.
Don't try to escape.
Don't try to escape. And he leaves, and Kurakin, you know, knows this, well, he's not really tied up all that tight. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so he...
And he can easily burn the ropes away using the candle.
Yeah, and he's like, this is not supposed to be this easy.
Yeah, it's supposed to be this easy.
So then he calls Solo on his little phone. Now, that was one bit right before this.
I love those little pins, by the way.
So Solo calls in and checks in with headquarters to see, have they heard anything more? No. Okay. Have you heard anything from Emilian? No, not since his last check-in. Okay. Can you connect to Mr. Waverly? No, he's on special assignment.
What?
Okay. Well, all right. Well, nothing to report so far. Okay, we're good. Then Kurakin escapes and says, well, he was knocked out by an older man with a cane.
You see, now I want to see the fan fiction where Moneypenny travels to the New York office of Uncle and they have like some kind of convention. I want to see like the MI6 secretarial pool and the Uncle secretarial pool have like some kind of giant adventure together. What was her name? Wanda.
Wanda. Yeah, well, yeah. Moneypenny and Wanda.
Moneypenny and Wanda. I want that now. I want to see that now. And you know what? There's somebody I can call to make that happen. You know her name. Mm-hmm. You know who I'm talking about. There's somebody I can call who would love to write that story. Moneypenny and Wanda.
So, and I may get the order off here, unless you've got better notes. But
I probably don't have better notes.
Okay, so at some point, I'm trying to think here.
My note-taking skills have...
Solo gets another call from Wanda.
Right, and they've identified the author of the diaries is...
Well, they've done a make on Uncle Charlie, even though he did not request one. That really never...
Well, I suspect that...
That I suspect that perhaps Mr. Waverly ordered that before he left on special assignment.
Yes. Right. That.
Right. And it turns out that Uncle Charlie is, in fact, the thought dead Charles Coltrane, the author of the diaries and previous Thrush agent.
And at that point, it's like, everything has fallen into place. Now, at some point in this, you see Kurakin sneak into the cellar of the house.
Because Solo told him, okay, well, come to the house, sneak in, and help us try to find these diaries.
Right. So then we cut to Uncle Charlie working on a car, and Solo
confronts him about Thrush.
And apparently, yes, he is indeed a former Thrush agent.
Da, da, da.
Thrush never knew about his double life here, and he just, when he was thought dead, he just went back here and tried to live the quiet life. And then Niece came out to visit, found the diaries, wrote the book, and Zark is in the house. The entire house is bugged, and he doesn't dare do anything because they'll kill his wife. Mm. We cut to Kurakin, who is in the basement, which looks suspiciously like an alleyway, because I think they used a bunch of brick flats. Unless they've got a major pigeon basement problem in Mainville, Ohio.
Which is not impossible.
Those Ohio basement pigeons. So he finds the ant trussed up in the basement.
Like a Thanksgiving turkey.
Then a fight ensues, and...
And Ilya, that's a pretty good fight, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good fight.
It is to some really strange music, speaking of the Batman.
Yeah, connection. It's like, it's like scored like a John Philip Sousa march.
Now, for those of you who have had the grave misfortune to see the 1970s Doc Savage film, which ran out of money and actually scored the film with John Philip Sousa marches, the music they play sounds kind of like carnival music. It is a choice of music for this fight scene, comparable in its unfortunateness to the use of John Philip Sousa marches. It is horrendously, unnecessarily bouncy. It's bouncy music.
It keeps playing when they cut back to Napoleon and Jacqueline.
Yeah, so at this voice, like, well, you know, she remembers, but maybe the diaries are up in the attic. Because remember, he's been gradually returning. And I expect Sol to say, well, wait, speak up. I can't hear you over the fight music coming from the basement.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I gotta say at this point that my ability to take notes has deteriorated dramatically since college. But I think what happens is...
This is where the multi-stage Mexican standoff.
Yeah, the multi-stage Mexican standoff.
They get to go up the stairs. Solo grabs a chair. Advances with the chair. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I think the chair gets batted away. I think this may have been to show that Zark had, you know, some his metal hand had extra or something. Basically, smashes the chair and pulls a gun on Solo. So now,
the way this thing is blocked, there's no way Napoleon Solo couldn't have seen Zark from two floors away.
This doesn't matter. This is actually a gunfight. This is some sort of trumping game. Instead of playing cards, you're drawing guns.
Right.
So okay,
whichever side has more guns wins.
Or pulled out a gun most recently. I think we could probably do a card game with this. So now Zark's
got the drop on Napoleon.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then okay, but
no wait a minute. We get the drop on Zark.
No, then
but then is that when Buck shows up?
Yeah,
above
so wait,
Zark?
Actually, so wait, Solo gets the drop on Zark, right. I think, and then Buck shows up and gets the drop on Solo.
Turns out that the bookstore guy is working for Thrush.
Yes, but then Kurakin with the ant in tow shows up and points a gun at Buck, which of course means now Uncle has the drop on them. Mm-hmm. Despite that, they can all start shooting at any moment. But
then the devil's book critic shows up.
Right, so now they have the drop on them, along with basically the mysterious guy from X-14. Is there as well. And during all this, there's back and forth, some back and forth exposition. Because they, what was it like when Solo and Zark first meet, it's like, ah, you know, Solo, has, you know, we last crossed paths in Toga Bogo or whatever, you know.
Ah, Solo, we meet again.
You know, he does not say, ah, Napoleon Solo, my dear friend and bitter enemy, mostly because, you know, Mel Brooks and them would have sued, but, yeah. You know,
yeah,
it's basically that scene. And then, so at this point, okay, so we've got the evil literary critic now has the drop on them, and then...
But then the old guy.
And the old man does, and we are watching Man from U.N.C.L.E. here, does a mask pull. Splorp.
Yeah, he's like, whacks her with his cane, pulls off, his, you know, draws a gun, pulls off his mask, and it's...
Mr. Waverly.
And they're, well, what are you doing here? Well, we after you lost her at the cocktail party, we couldn't afford another, you know, another mistake like that.
Couldn't afford another mistake like that.
So I assigned myself to infiltrate.
Right. So he's just like, well, but how did you get into our infiltration unit? He's like, I infiltrated it. You know.
Okay, let's say that all together. 1, 2, 3. I infiltrated it.
So then
Ray, you didn't say it with us. 1, 2, 3. I infiltrated it.
Okay, so then the question that becomes, okay, well, fine. Where are the diaries? Well, that's when the aunt speaks up.
Right? I burned them in the oven.
You know,
they were so smutty.
I couldn't have those smutty books in the house. I burned them in the furnace over there.
And at that point, though, everybody has a good laugh, I guess.
And then I assume what happens is, because they don't make any reference to it, I assume that Solo and Kiriak and Mr. Waverly murder all the Thresh agents.
I assume they take them into custody and sweat them.
They took them into custody, sweated them, and then murdered them.
You
can't let them go.
I mean, okay, it's not the little decryption unit smashing into a million pieces,
at the end of Fear Eyes Only.
And then Golgo going, oh, well.
I got the impression it was similar to that,
where nobody had any reason to be here anymore.
So. Right, well, it's like, okay, so yeah, we cut back to Uncle HQ, and the aunt and uncle have gone into hiding in Florida, and she's not even allowed to tell Uncle what, mm-hmm. you know, where they are.
What their names are.
Thanks to the new atomic adhesion process, Uncle can actually put the ashes of the diaries back together, but Thrush has already called off any operations that Coltrane would have mentioned in the diaries, so it's a total stalemate.
That right there was the point where I called bullshit. You can't put it back together from ashes. You're lying, Waverly. You just made that up. I call shenanigans. I can accept everything else from this show except that.
What?
Dude? I'm calling bullshit. You can't atomically re-adhese anything.
Bite me,
Waverly.
David McCollum in a show where they use science magic to get physical evidence from nothing? What? You can't buy that at all? I'm...
No.
Really?
No, I cannot.
Oh, okay.
No, I cannot.
Enhance.
I don't actually watch a lot of NCIS. I'm aware that there is a show called NCIS, I'm aware that this guy that looks like Kiriakin on it, they refer to by the name Ducky,
well,
for whatever reason.
One of the spin-offs.
His name is Dr. Mallard, I believe.
No, well, that's the sense. Well, that's their sense of humor, isn't it? My name's Dr. Mallard. I'll call you Ducky. And so, I just lost the NCIS demographic, but whatever. I don't think we had a lot of them.
Like, was it NCIS?
I don't think we had a lot of
they
them.
They did mention in one episode that when he was younger, he looked a lot like Ilya Kuryakin.
That's good. Yeah. Well, so that's good.
I did watch like one episode. There's one of the spinoffs, like Los Angeles. I thought, okay, NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigation Services. They're basically the FBI for crimes committed on this property.
As far as I know, the whole subtext of the show is landlubbers suck.
Well, but the thing is, the Los Angeles one, I'm like, and apparently that NCIS, that one stands for Nebulous Covert Intelligence Service, because they're like having somebody black bagged, and it's all like, aren't you just supposed to investigate crimes involving Navy personnel and Navy property? You should be like, you know.
Is that the one where Connor McLeod is their recurring nemesis?
I think that's the main NCIS one. But the thing is, it was like.
Well, the Kurgan is like SpongeBob's boss, so.
That's right.
I mean, they're superior, you know, it was like George Smiley's aunt, is the way, mm-hmm. I can't remember the actress's name, but it was just like, mm-hmm. This is like a spy show. This is mm-hmm. like full up, you know, we're blackbagging people
more,
and droning.
Yeah,
and...
way more counterterrorism and stuff than you
is
would
it, Is that the one with LL Cool J and Robin the Boy Wonder?
I literally have no idea. I mean, this was like, I was flipping channels like, you know, and then like, what the heck? Oh, NCIS? What the?
And then Sam Beckett eats gumbo and beats people up on the other show. I don't know.
I don't know.
Regular NCIS is pretty cool. I'm not sure it has anything to do with the Navy anymore, but it has a neat little cast of quirky characters that solve.
That's
Mark Harmon looks pissed off all the time. I always thought of Mark Harmon as this nice guy, but every time I turn that show on, he's like really, really angry at somebody.
Well, he's like old and craggy now. You got to go with some personality trait there. I guess.
And we spend most of our TV time watching shows from the 60s anyway.
So wrap it up. Basically, the diaries are burnt up, but no problem. The school teacher has an idea for a new book about a school teacher who finds a bunch of diaries containing intelligence information, gets involved with a couple of intelligence agents. You can sort of see Solo and Kurakin, who, just sort of like, no.
Roll their eyes and contemplating shooting her and burying her in a shallow grave in Central Park.
Yes. And then roll credits.
Once again, we kind of take the piss here, but that was an entertaining hour.
It was funny. It was funny. And again, I wasn't expecting, and maybe I should have been, I wasn't quite expecting a mild send up of the whole, the spy genre there. But I mean, when we show the opening credits of Ellipsis's arc.
Ellipsis.
Because again, 60s, your credits are basically kind of evolving like it's like a playbill. There was an article I read somewhere about, you look at like older credits where it's like they do all the credits in the opening.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it really evolved, it evolved
including
out of a playbill.
Including listing who all the characters are
playing. Yeah. And so it kind of evolved out of the playbill you'd get handed, these are all the actors in the show you've gone to see.
I forget the guy's name. John Houseman is Ellipsis Zark. I forget. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what the guy's name was.
But so, right out of the gate, we knew there's a character named Ellipsis Zark.
And then right there, you got me.
And I mean, there's a picture. That. I mean, he's a major guest star. So there's a picture of him. He's got the little silver hand, the ball cap. I'm like, what have we gotten ourselves into?
A highly hilarious hour of television that we then had a highly hilarious, fun time reporting on. So that's what we got ourselves into.
It was a lot of fun, but I'm betting they weren't all quite this wacky.
Or what I have read is actually they do kind of get this wacky. That this is actually par for the course.
Ellipsis's arc?
Yeah.
Now that is,
I think, Mr. Ellison's talent for wordplay.
That's a pinnacle right there. I am never going to forget that
I might get that tattooed on one of my butt cheeks. I love that. That's terrific. It is my understanding the show does kind of get that wacky as it goes on.
Right. I was expecting it to be even more Batman-like at this point.
Yeah,
I kind of was, too.
I thought the show actually showed a little bit of restraint compared to similar period Batman.
Well, okay, the thing is, a comic book show, if you're going to do it like a comic book with the brightly costumed characters.
Now, this isn't my thought, but it has been pointed out to me that the Adam West Batman was apparently physically powerful enough that when he hit you, onomatopoeic words materialized out of thin air describing how he hit you. That's a badass, right? That's a badass right there.
The actor's freaking Wikipedia picture is that credits. Is that credit?
Yes.
Love it. Theo Marcuse is Ellipsis.
No, I mean, he's great. He's absolutely great. Is just, I mean, if you need a secondhand Blofeld, he's not too bad.
He's really not bad. Now, for the sake of argument here, we're kind of ragging on it a little bit, but we mean no disrespect at all. I think we are watching the show in the spirit it was intended.
I think this was not meant to be 100% straight up.
Yeah, this isn't Jean Le Carré's Man from Uncle.
He died later that same year at the age of 47.
Oh,
what?
No.
Jesus, I'm about to be 40. He was 47?
Yes.
That's what 47 looked like in the 60s.
Well, he was also a World War II Navy hero who served on the same submarine as the guy who wrote Run Silent, Run Deep.
Seriously? Wow. Geez. Good gracious.
Had a silver star, a bronze star, and a presidential unit citation.
Damn.
Well, God bless you, Mr. Marcuse.
Huh.
Well, son of a gun.
Well, First Doctor, 55.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He died in a traffic accident.
Okay. Not that we're sad that he's dead.
No, right.
No, but that's still bad, but yeah.
That makes me feel better about being 47.
Because he looked... Yeah, that was... Damn.
In a 1966 movie called The Last of the Secret Agents, he played Zoltan Shubak, which I now want to see just because.
Zoltan Shubak. That's not as good as Ellipsis Zark.
It's up there.
That's fair.
It's up there.
I grant you that it's up there, but it's not as good as Ellipsis Zark. So, yeah, that's a thumbs up from all of us on this particular Man from Uncle.
Yeah, no, this was fun. This was a lot of fun.
All right, good.
I mean, if you're going to adapt a script for the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie, I
wouldn't pick this one.
No.
Yeah. Although I do want, I'm going to reiterate this. I want to see the episode where Moneypenny is like a loaned out. What's the word? Detached service. Where Moneypenny is on detached service in the U.N.C.L.E. secretarial pool. There's this running gag between me and this friend we have in common about how Moneypenny will cut you. She will cut you. But anyway.
In the kind of terrible Halloween episode of Star Trek, he was Korob.
Korob and Wanda? Was it Wanda? What was her name?
Korob and Sylvia.
Sylvia, that's it. Korob and Sylvia.
Okay.
He was that guy?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That makes me happy. Okay. Oh, I loved him. Theo Marcuse was Korob.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that cracks me up. That makes me so happy. That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
And yet again, the conflicts of 60s television shows we all love continues.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to tonight's episode of Agents of Cool. I am always number 6, all lowercase, all words, at agentsof.cool. Ray?
Ray at agentsof.cool.
Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, all lowercase, no period, at agentsof.cool.
Thank you, as always, for listening. Again, if you have any particular requests, things you'd like us to cover, comments, questions, analysis, please let us know, and be sure and tune in next time. Thrush Thug jumps up from doesn't jump up. Thrush Thug. I'm going to start saying Thrush Henchman.
Agent,
Thrush
Henchman, thug. Operative.
Thrush Operative, that's good.